This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning, a very good morning to you, and welcome to the Pacific Show. This is Belinda Cora from ABC's Pacific Journalism Network program, joining you this morning from the ABC House in the capital city of Port Moresby, Papua New Guinea. I must say, this is the very first time we're bringing you the show out of the Pacific Island nation that is also already celebrating 50 years of independence. Thank you for joining me this morning here on the Pacific Beach Show with all the latest news from the Pacific. Coming up today, we get the latest out of Fiji, where the country's biggest drug trial is taking place. Also, Pacific nations team up to create new ocean reserves.
It's time to move beyond these voluntary pledges that we're making here and recognize that climate action cooperation must be based on international law.
And we find out why everyone's favorite clownfish is shrinking.
When we found it, yeah, we were definitely surprised. I freaked out a little initially. I thought, what did I get wrong?
Pacific Beat comes to you from the island lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Let's get started. But first, a dual Australian and Nigerian citizen has been arrested and charged with human trafficking, with police alleging she lured and tricked Papua New Guinea nationals into working on farms in Australia. The Australian Federal Police alleged the 56-year-old Binta Abubakar used fake scholarships to lure interested PNG students to Australia. Once they arrived in Australia, police alleged she would then charge excessive costs and force them to work on farms. Detective Superintendent Adrian Telfer says some were forced to live in a shipping container and others had been driven long distances in the boot of a car.
This is a job that we've been doing for a couple of years. We've invested quite a large number of our resources
to it.
So, yeah, we do find it disturbing. You've got to understand, these are individuals who are young. That's a point of vulnerability. They're extremely isolated. They are pursuing an education, a dream, to come here to Australia, opportunities that they don't find in their own country. And they're placed into a position that they weren't prepared for and didn't know how to get out of it. Look, there's a lot of behaviour here that we believe they were under threat to actually carry out these services, and ultimately they were working for nothing. To my knowledge, not physically harmed, but suffice to say, some of them at times were living in fairly oppressive conditions. We had several living in a shipping container. We have information to suggest that they are being driven long distances, some in the boot of a car. Fairly oppressive conditions.
AFP Detective Superintendent Adrian Telfer speaking at a press conference about the arrest of a Nigerian and Australian citizen who's been charged with human trafficking. Pacific Beat. We go to Fiji next, where witnesses in the first week of the country's biggest drug trial has given an insight into the operations of transnational criminal networks. Seven people are facing a range of drug offences over the seizure of more than 4 tons of methamphetamines in the tourist town of Nandi last year. So far, the courts heard testimony that the drugs were brought into the country on a super yacht with drop-off coordinates provided by satellite phone under the observation of a mysterious Russian. ABC's Fiji reporter Lide Movono has been covering the hearing and joins us now. Good morning, Lide.
Nyandra Venakasusa, good to be talking to you this morning.
I know, good to hear your voice too here. Lide, just take us through what's happened. How did this massive shipment get into the country, and what's been coming out in court so far?
Belinda, it's been a rather exciting trial to be listening in on what we understand, or at least the allegations being revealed in court, are that the drugs came in by sea just before Christmas of 2023. A barge was hired from a very popular marina here in the western side called Vunda, and it made three trips before the final one actually met up with a super yacht, which was anchored off of the Yasawa group of islands, another important tourist area in the country, but just off of the Fiji's EEZ was where the meth was offloaded over 2 hours into the barge and then taken to Fantasy Island before it was stored in Danarau. And, you know, for those who you might remember, Danarau is possibly the most important tourist location in Fiji, where it was stored for a few days before being taken elsewhere to be repackaged and then moved around. It took a whole 3.5 weeks before the police got wind of the operations and actually conducted a raid. But so far in court, we've heard from the barge owner, the captain, and people who were accomplices or part of the operation who have been granted immunity and therefore are testifying. But what we understand is exactly how it was brought in, where it was moved around here in Nandi, and then where they were stored, Belinda.
Lithe, it's not just the size of this seizure that's shocking. The way it was all organized sounds sophisticated. What does that tell us about how these networks operate in the Pacific?
You're absolutely right, Belinda. It tells us how well organized and how confident the syndicates are, because what we're talking about is, what was actually seized by the police is 4.15 tons in one location, 1.1 in another location, and, you know, a few bits here and there. So the shipment itself was a lot more than that, is the assumption that the authorities are making. And they needed construction vehicles. They needed a crane to offload the drugs from the barge onto the mainland. So we know they're well organized. We know they're very confident, you know, because they're hiring from important marinas that are frequented by locals and then stored right there on Danarau. So they're quite bold. We understand also from the allegations being revealed in court is that they use legitimate businesses in a luxury tourist area to store the drugs and to move it around right under everyone's noses, you know, right next to the authorities. So this wasn't just smuggling. This was a full-scale importation, repackaging and redistribution, of product using Fiji as a hub. So it's the first time ever that we're hearing firsthand accounts from people who were allegedly part of this operation, just to tell us how the Pacific is being used as not just a drugs highway, but, you know, a repackaging and redistribution branch.
And what are the defense lawyers saying, and how are they pushing back against the prosecution's case?
Well, the push is not that much, Belinda. What we're hearing from the very first day is that the bulk of the summary of facts, you know, about the majority of the information presented by the state is agreed upon now. What we understand from all of the counsels, the defense counsels that have spoken this week, is they're claiming duress, which basically means that, you know, these seven accused people, along with the two who had pleaded guilty earlier in the week, are not disputing that they did what they're being accused of, but they're saying that they did it out of fear, that they were frightened of the cartels who were allegedly at the start of this, you know, distribution and production phase. So there's not very much pushback. That you're hearing the defense lawyers, you know, pretty much trying to get the witnesses to say that, you know, they too were scared, and that their defendants, their clients rather, were scared of someone, and that's why they were part of this network.
Lithe, how is this playing out in Fiji? Are we seeing much public reaction or pressure on the justice system and government?
Yes, absolutely, Belinda. There's been very strong public reaction. I mean, these operations allegedly took place in late December of 2023. The seizure happened in early Jan. So it's been, you know, a year and a half since the people of Fiji woke up to this very large shipment being seized and a big group of people. Initially, there were 16 people that were taken in by police, and people have watched as the defendants, or rather the accused people, tried to flee the country not once but twice, Belinda. So they're seeing drugs allegedly removed from evidence. You know, they saw as the drugs were destroyed in a very public fashion. So they're seeing a lot of delaying tactics on the part of the defense in you know, trying to get the trial to be prolonged as much as possible. So the people are paying attention, and people have opinions, and they're calling for these nine accused people to be made an example of. You know, they're calling on the police to do better, on the authorities to do better. I think the people of Fiji are shocked by the scale of it too, and how public these things were being stored, and politically there's a lot of pressure on police and customs and even the government to explain how these drugs got past everyone and in such a public place. And even as we're reporting on it every day, it's getting quite a lot of engagement on social media. People want to know whether Fiji's justice system can even handle a case this big and this public, Belinda.
Do you get a sense that this case could spark lasting changes, whether in law enforcement policy or how the region works together on organized crimes?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the Pacific security and defense issues have been very high on the agenda of, you know, not just Fiji, but our regional bodies. The Pacific Island Forum leaders have talked about defense and security on end for at least the last decade. But drugs trafficking is most definitely very high on everyone's agenda, because the situation in Fiji is quite similar in magnitude and in terms of sophistication to several other countries in the Pacific, as you know from, you know, the work that our own team have been doing together. So this is something that Tonga is dealing with, that Samoa is dealing with, and it's beginning to creep into the fabric of some of the other Pacific Island countries. So it's definitely a very prominent and emerging challenge. But here in Fiji, it's even more so, especially because every month or so, we are seeing people who are entrusted with the care and the security of our borders and of our customs being taken in for, you know, allegations that they're part of the operations. Just last month, the head of our customs intelligence unit and accomplices were also arrested after they tried to aid in the entry of a drug shipment that came in by air from the Americas. So it's a big issue now that Fiji's having to grapple with, and the Narcotics Bureau is working with Australian Federal Police and some other regional crime units to tackle this at a regional level. And given that it's a transnational crime and a transnational challenge, it only makes sense that people be working together across borders to also try to deal with it. But here in Fiji, there's a lot of emphasis around port security, interagency coordination, and especially also corruption. So yes, there's a momentum, but there's also a lot of work that needs to doing, Belinda.
Lee, there, before we let you go, shifting gears now, Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese arrives in Fiji this afternoon for talks with Sitiveni Rambuka. Why is this visit significant, especially coming so soon after the Australian election?
Yes, Albanese had put out a statement late last night saying that this is a deliberate signal on his part, that this is his way of saying that the Pacific remains a central part of Australia's foreign policy. Prime Minister Albanese now comes in, and it's just really a few weeks after the elections. It's quite early into his second term for him to be making his first international trip and making Fiji the first stop of that trip, because of course he's on his way to the G7 in Canada and stopping in Seattle in the United States before that. So it says quite a lot. It's quite symbolic. But what I'm hearing as well from sources within the Fijian Prime Minister Sitiveni Rumbuka's office is that this is a very important trip for the Prime Minister too. And as you know, Australia is Fiji's most important ally in terms of our diplomatic relations and in terms of our political coordination as well. And we do get more aid from Australia than any other country that operates here in the Pacific. So it's clear that the two leaders want to ensure that, the personal and the political closeness that exists between the two of them is an extension of how Fiji and Australia relate to each other. But also, Belinda, given that the Pacific Island Forum and several other crop agencies are headquartered here in Fiji, this is not just about Fiji. This is about the Pacific in a broader sense. So I think for Albanese, it's his way of telling the Fiji Vuvale as well as the Pacific Vuvale that Australia is committed to being the central partner here in the Pacific. And he's still shopping around for more support in terms of hosting the Pacific COP in the next couple of years, Belinda.
Lithe, thank you for talking to us and updating us on the latest out of Fiji. Vinaka.
Vinaka valevu.
What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions, like why is it hard to get medicine you need in the Pacific?
It came to a point where he was admitted where he got blood poisoning. He needed antibiotics for that, and that was not available.
Join me, Scott Whitehair, on Polytalk.
Tuesday, 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Turning to politics quickly, leaders from Solomon Islands and Vanuatu have announced a plan to create a new ocean reserve, spanning 6 million square kilometres and connecting multiple countries. Solomon Islands Prime Minister Jeremiah Manele says the Melanesian Ocean Reserve is being led by his country and Vanuatu and will also connect with Papua New Guinea and New Caledonia. His comment at the UN Oceans Conference in France comes as countries push for more countries to ratify the High Seas Treaty. But Vanuatu's climate change minister, Ralph Reginvanu, says international treaties need to have legal obligations rather than voluntary pledges for it to work in reducing carbon emissions. He says an advisory opinion to be delivered later this year by the International Court of Justice would clarify the obligations of states when it comes to climate change.
So our message here is it's time to move beyond these voluntary pledges that we're making here and recognise that climate action and cooperation must be based on international law and is a binding legal duty. And we hope that more and more of these advisory opinions and decisions come out. They will create this pathway that we're asking for. We're urging all states to align their ocean climate policies with the legal obligations clarified in the ITLOS advisory opinion and in anticipation of the ICJ advisory opinion. More than 100 other states and organisations joined Vanuatu in the ICJ advisory opinion seeking clarity regarding legal duties, and it was historically the largest case ever before the ICJ in terms of number of states. We must use this momentum to drive real enforceable action, not just here, but also looking ahead, particularly at the COPs.
Vanuatu's Climate Change Minister Ralph Reginvanu speaking at the UN Climate Oceans Conference. It's time to take a look at what's making headlines around the Pacific. And to do that, I'm joined by producer Kyle Evans. Kyle, how are you today?
I'm very good, Belinda. It's wonderful to be here in what is a very historic show coming out of Port Moresby for the first time. And you've made history. Congratulations.
Thank you very much, Kyle. I feel really honoured and privileged to be waking up very early this morning and to be also chatting with you as well.
I know the feeling.
So, Kyle, let's get into it. A pilot has faced court for smuggling more than 50 kilos of drugs into Australia. What's the verdict?
That is right, Belinda. So 11 years in jail with a non-parole period of 8 years was the sentence handed down by the Supreme Court in the Queensland city of Bundaberg on Wednesday. So the man sentenced was Bernard Hamilton Alexander, a 54-year-old pilot who was busted back in 2023 after he flew 56 kilograms of methamphetamine from PNG to Australia. He was actually one of five men arrested when he landed at the small town of Monto. And despite that he was little more than a paid hand in the operation, the court found that he was instrumental in the scheme, having flown the plane and even recruiting the co-pilot. So ultimately, it was the plane that proved his undoing, with the court being told that it was actually a surveillance device within the plane itself that helped the AFP with their investigation and make the arrest.
Kyle, an Australian basketball legend will be joining the basketball program at the University of Hawaii. Who is it?
That is right. A story quite close to my heart, Belinda. So Patty Mills has joined the program as its new general manager. So Mr. Mills obviously comes highly decorated as a five-time Olympian for Australia, an NBA champion, and a very proud Indigenous man and advocate. So it's a newly created role, from what I understand, the general manager. It sounds very fancy. He will support student athlete mentorship and development. He will also play a part in recruiting, along with fundraising and community engagement. It turns out, Belinda, I didn't actually know this, he's a longtime resident of Hawaii, having spent the last decade living there during his off seasons.
Oh, so does that mean he has retired from playing basketball?
Well, that is the million-dollar question, Belinda. So up until recently, he was signed with the LA Clippers of the NBA on a one-year contract. But at 37 years old, I can't imagine retirement would be too far off. So there was actually a lot of speculation that he might potentially return to Australia to finish off his career. Who knows if that's the case now, given this recent news, but we will see. I guess the big question is whether this role will be something sort of permanent and long-term, or is it more of a symbolic role? Is it more of an ambassador type role? I think that'll be the thing to really wait and see. I know as a basketball fan myself, and as someone who actually got to play against Patty Mills when I was growing up, I'd love to see him back in Australia and playing on this side of the world.
Thanks, Kyle, for that. And in rugby league, the PNG Hunters have made an interesting team decision as they gear up for their Queensland Cup game against the Sunshine Coast Falcons.
Yes, very interesting, Belinda. So they've named a kid by the name of Douglas David. Well, I say kid, he's 24 years old. But he's going to debut at fullback in place of the injured Sonny Wabo. But it's proved to be somewhat of a controversial move among the fans, who are asking why he's playing over the very popular fullback Morea Morea. So one Facebook post I saw yesterday had garnered more than 500 comments and 3,000 likes after questioning the decision, and actually demanded that the Hunters release Morea so he could basically chase opportunities overseas. Now, for context, Morea won the Rising Star Award a couple of years ago in the Queensland Cup. He became a real fan favourite before an ankle injury sadly sidelined him. Since then, he's had a trial with the North Queensland Cowboys. He was a late addition at the Pacific Championship, scoring a try for PNG last year. So I guess many people expected that he'd be back in a full-time capacity with the Hunters this year, but that just hasn't been the case. He hasn't been able to nail down a spot for some reason. There hasn't been a lot of information about it, and obviously it's got some fans riled up, and now in a must-win game, Coach Paul Ayton has gone with a debutant in his position in what is a must-win game at home.
It is a lot of pressure indeed, but we wish him the best of luck, and thank you very much, Kyle, for that update.
Not a problem at all, Belinda.
That was producer Kyle Evans, and you can catch the Hunters against the Falcons on Sunday, 3 p.m. PNG time at the National Football Stadium in Port Moresby.
Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music for the finest in ska, rocksteady, roots, dub, sizzling dancehall, and all the hottest releases from around the Pacific.
Hi, I'm Ronnie Coreni from Sorong Samurai, and you're listening to Island Music. My name is Tieni from Te Tangio Te Kara, and you're listening to Island Music.
Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music.
Saturdays, 12 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
A crowd of fascinated onlookers surrounded the Samoan exhibition at the World Expo in Osaka, Japan, as a group of performers sang and danced to mark the recent Samoan Independence Day. The group were part of a larger delegation of Samoan and other Pacific Island countries at the expo, which has been running since April. On the day the ABC visited, they were forced to move inside to a smaller crowd because of torrential rain. But it didn't stop the crowd surrounding them and clapping along. Fa'alavu au Perina Sila Tualau Lele is the head of Samoa's delegation and spoke with ABC's Nick Sess.
Samoa's representation here in Osaka Expo 2025 is not only to show and invite you to the beauty of our culture, our traditions, and to show our warm hospitality, but we also very much align ourselves with the theme of this expo, designing lives for a better future for our people. And our theme here is empowerment. And our government, our country, is people-centered development, where people is at the heart of all our development aspirations. And we work very closely with our partners, Australia, New Zealand, Japan, of course, China, and many others, United States, Europe. And being here in Osaka is to showcase that we have a lot to offer to the world, not only for trade, investment, business opportunities, but also to invest in renewable energy sectors, in our agriculture and fishery sectors. And to also show that Samoa is an active global citizen on climate change. Right now there's an oceans conference, the importance of oceans management and sustainable development to our government, to our people, as a small island nation, but with a big voice, big heart. That's why we are here.
And tell me about the reaction just in, like, behind us over here. It's been pretty great, hey, to the dancing.
The reaction to our performances here has been truly amazing. Starting from Sunday, 8th of June, where we had our National Day celebrations, the official events, we had over 1,000 people attending the two events. And then we had another special event yesterday outside. It was incredible. And then today, because of the rain, we're inside. The reaction we have been receiving is very positive. There's a lot of questions like, how can we get to Samoa? What can we do when we get to Samoa? And which routes do we go to? And what can we learn? And this is very important for us as the Embassy of Samoa. We are based in Tokyo because we promote people-to-people exchange. And that's why we have all of these activities to showcase Samoa, to invite people to visit Samoa, but also our people-to-people exchange programs that we have with high school students, rugby, sports. We've had judo, we've had soccer students exchange. So with this, we hope to foster mutual understanding, especially for the young people. They are indeed the future of our country. So it is my hope that through this, we will increase awareness about Samoa and invite people to come.
Fa'alavu au Perina Sila Tualau Lele is the head of Samoa's delegation. The reporter there in Japan is Nick Sass. Heading to PNG now, where cardinals, bishops and other senior church leaders will be hosted by Pope Leo at his official residence later today to celebrate the coming canonization of 8 candidates for sainthood. Known as Terce and the Ordinary Consistory for the Canonization of the Blesseds, the gathering is seen as the final step before a nominated person is declared a saint. The current list includes the Blessed Peter Torod from Papua New Guinea, who would become the first male saint from Oceania following the canonization of Australia's Mary MacKillop in 2010. The head of the Catholic Church in PNG, Cardinal Sir John Ribatt, says the process has taken a while, but it was made possible by the late Pope Francis following his visit to the country last year.
You know, Pope Francis initiated the process. The bishops asked him when he announced that he was coming to PNG. We wrote a letter asking him whether it would be possible for him to canonize Blessed Peter Torot in his visit to Papua New Guinea. And he said no. And what he was saying is that all the preparation must be met to prepare a candidate for canonization. All the processes must be followed. But of course, for us, he suspended the requirement for a miracle, because there are many signs already Blessed Peter Torot has shown when people are praying, asking his intercession for help. And one of the work that the committee did here, they asked throughout the diocese, those who had the experience of Blessed Peter Torot in their prayers and so on. So then they required about 60, and they did. So they got over 60, and that was fulfilled, the requirement fulfilled, and all the other works was done. And at the end, what we did here was sent to Rome, to this department, the dicastery, that is in charge of promoting candidates to be canonized. And then when they looked through it and also and with other requirements, they checked it out and so on. And they saw that it was done well and the requirements were fulfilled. I mean, the documentation was presented to late Pope Francis when he was still alive. He signed it. And then not long after that, he died. But he initiated the process. And then he completed the process by certifying that, yes, Blessed Peter Torot is ready now for canonization. So he is now on the list of those who are to be canonized. So that is an important part of it, and we were happy that it happened this way. There were many questions also, because we knew that Pope Francis will canonize him after when he gets back from Papua New Guinea to Rome. Then he will have the date set for canonization. But it was not possible because he passed on.
When Pope Francis died, did you have any doubts at all whether Blessed Peter Torot would become a saint, or were you confident that he would be a saint?
And there were many questions saying, will he still be on the list for canonization? And I checked with them and also the committee. They said, yes, his name is on the list already. And Pope Francis has certified that he is ready for canonization. So we will be really happy celebrating his canonization.
Do we know when that will be?
13th will be the gathering to mark the date now for canonization, the consistory on the 13th. It will be there to mark this date for canonization. So the date is not known yet, but as the preparation and everything is ready with all other candidates for canonization, but the date will be only mentioned to us after the 13th, when they have met, decide what day will be.
I wonder what the mood is like in Papua New Guinea now that his name is on that final list of candidates for sainthood.
I was asked by others that Peter Torot will be canonized. People were asking if he would be canonized here in PNG. And I said no, because Pope Francis just came and visited us, and for him to come again would be not easy to do that. So anyhow, I told them that he will be in Rome, and while the preparation is for this year and next year, and I think the preparation in the conference, that the celebration will be throughout the diocese of Papua New Guinea, Solomon Island, and maybe other Pacific countries also will follow, because there are centers in their dioceses named after Blessed Peter Torot, like here in Papua New Guinea, the same. And for his canonization, for sure, it won't be happening here in PNG, but bishops and some people are saying they will be in Rome to witness the celebration of canonization.
Are you going back to Rome for that?
Yes, I'm going to Rome. I will go back for that. For me, I'm looking forward to it. And also, some people are saying also they will. So it's really a big thing for the church in Papua New Guinea, also in the Pacific.
That's Cardinal Sir John Ribatt, the head of the Catholic Church in Papua New Guinea, looking forward to being in Rome for the canonization of Blessed Peter Torot, and he was speaking to Caroline Tiriman. According to a new research which took place in Papua New Guinea, the humble clownfish can shrink in warm waters. Melissa Vestige is a PhD candidate in marine sciences from the Newcastle University and explained to Agnes Tupou about this discovery.
Initially, actually, when we started the research, we didn't realize that shrinking was a thing that these coral reef fish could do. So as part of my research, I'm looking at what anemone fish need to have in terms of skills to be future-proof. And so I came out into the field to monitor, amongst other things, their growth and in relation to environmental stresses like temperature. And when we got into the field, which was in February 2023, we turned out to be right at the cusp of a marine heat wave. And so from there, this monitoring of growth is something that's really interesting because these guys, we know they have quite plastic growth because of their social structure. But it wasn't until after we'd done the field work that we realized, whoa, they're shrinking. What does that mean? So we hadn't observed it before. So for us, it was actually really surprising to find it.
Melissa, I'm curious, though, about, you know, the process itself. Like, how were you able to measure the fish shrinking?
To measure these fish, it's relatively easy, actually, because they one social group sits on one anemone and the anemone doesn't typically move. And so as long as you know where to find that anemone on the reef, you know that you're dealing with the same fish. And so we use scuba, we visit them, we monitor the water temperatures, we see if they're breeding, things like that. But so once every month, we also would go to these groups and catch them underwater with hand nets. And then you can actually measure them underwater. And you take photos to make sure that you're dealing with the same individuals because they have unique markings. And so it's quite an easy thing to do actually underwater. And it's not super stressful for the fish because if you're good at it, it takes, you know, under a minute and they're back on the anemone.
Wow. And I mean, were you surprised by the findings of this research?
When we found it, yeah, we were definitely surprised. I freaked out a little initially. I thought, what did I get wrong? But we were definitely surprised by it. We hadn't observed this type of shrinking before, and it was actually quite common. So we saw it in 100 of the individuals. I recorded 134 individuals through this time frame. It was not something we'd seen before.
Melissa, I mean, look, probably the biggest question most would want to see is be answered is, why do they shrink?
Yeah, it's a great question to know why they shrink. We try to, that was a bit of a head scratcher for us too initially, because these guys, they live in social groups where size is super important. And so typically if you get smaller, you risk maybe losing your social position in the group. But what we found in the end is that the shrinking comes with a pattern of enhanced ability to navigate environmental stress. So not only do they shrink when they need to, they also seem to bounce back a bit more when they can. And we saw that it had a survival advantage. So those that had the ability to shrink throughout the heat stress event, they were able to survive the entire heat wave. And so it might be a survival benefit that comes with shrinking.
And so, I mean, is there a particular temperature, you know, like, is there some sort of cutoff mark, right, where they start shrinking?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I'm not sure there's like a real threshold that we've been able to specify so far. It's because a lot of our work is observational. And so we're just monitoring the environment as stress happens, but we're doing it at the level of each individual anemone. And we did find that the more heat stress there is, the more likely they are to shrink and the stronger that shrinking effect would be. But it was with a time-lagged effect. So it might be that it's also to do with how long they've been exposed to stress. And what we're thinking it might have to do with is that if you're able to shrink just a little bit, if it's really, really hot, it allows you buy yourself a bit more time, basically, by potentially lowering your metabolic demand so that you have to fuel a slightly smaller factory whilst you're waiting for the environment to become a little bit less critical.
What about the implication of this research, right? Given warming oceans, what does this then mean for the clownfish?
Clownfish, they're particularly vulnerable in a sense because they are site dependent. So when the environment gets really hot, they don't have an opportunity to move away from that area to find a cooler environment. And so it could be that this is a strategy that site attached coral reef fish can use when the environment gets really, really intense and they need to put up with it. But on the whole, we're also wondering whether this gives us an additional explanation for why we're finding smaller marine fishes as oceans continue to warm. So there's other theories about that that relate to, for example, fisheries, where maybe they're catching the bigger individuals. It's that individuals maybe just don't grow as big as they used to. And now we found something that could add to that, a little bit of information suggesting that if they can't get away from their environment, maybe it's a strategy for them to survive when it gets really, really hot.
Wow, so fascinating. Well, you know, is this behavior, you know, the shrinking itself also occurring maybe in other fish species as well, or is this just particular to clownfish?
That's a really big question that we also have. So this is the first time we've observed it in adults, in adult coral reef fish. And so we'd love to collaborate and get in touch with other research groups that have an opportunity to see how widespread is this shrinking mechanism. Is it something that's restricted only to tropical species, for example, because they live closer to that thermal threshold? Is it something that's restricted to anemone fish specifically because they are so site attached, or maybe other species that are really site attached? So those are really great questions that we'd love to answer in the future.
And speaking about future, what are the next steps of your research, you know, moving forward?
Yes, so we'd love to do some follow-up studies to actually take it from field observation into controlled settings to understand exactly what are these shrinking mechanisms, what are the pathways. So is it food resources? Is it something that's direct? Is it something to do with the anemone habitat? And also to understand how widespread the shrinking phenomenon is so that we can start to see whether this is something that's just specific to anemone fish or whether other species would be able to do it.
Melissa Vestige is a PhD candidate in marine sciences from Newcastle University.
Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music for the finest in ska, rocksteady, roots, dub, sizzling dancehall, and all the hottest releases from around the Pacific.
Hi, I'm Ronnie Kareni from Sorong Samurai, and you're listening to Island Music.
My name is Tieni from Te Tangi o Te Kara, and you're listening to Island Music.
Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music.
Saturdays, 12 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Turning to sports now, another battle royal can be anticipated in Singatoka tomorrow when host nation Fiji lock horns once again with Samoa to decide who will be Oceania Women's Rugby Champions for 2025. 2 years ago, Manusina got the job done by a single point, but last year it was Fiji who came out on top, beating the arch rivals 27-13. The two sides have warmed up for what essentially is a grand final by scoring big wins over Tonga, but tomorrow is expected to be a much closer and hard-fought encounter. Fresh from running in three trials against the Tongans, Davina Lasini will line up again on the wing again with former Manusina, and says she says it's hard to separate her team from the Fijians.
I think we're pretty close. Knowing with Fiji, they have their Super W team, and with us, we just come together like a few weeks before the games. But I think Monsina's doing pretty well in terms of coming together and playing well together as well. And this year, yeah, we've got a stronger team, so it would be a good competition for this game coming up.
I noticed after the victory over Tonga, your captain speaking after the game, she talked about basically never the same team turns up twice for a whole variety of reasons.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It
must make life quite difficult, I would have thought, in terms of understanding one another and working together as a team.
I think off the field, we're pretty close, and we do include everyone. So it can be difficult at times, but we do try to get on the same page and be good for game day.
Much is made, of course, of the opportunities that the Fijian team get that Ranasinghe don't. You've mentioned Super W, which is an obvious one. Most, if not all, of their players play in Super W. So they get that regular competition. And yet, Ranasinghe, I mean, there are huge gaps between international matches for Samoa. It must be very frustrating for you.
Yeah, it's okay. Like some girls do Super W, some play club. So I think it's just getting as much game time as we can leading up to when we do come together as one.
And you've got the World Cup, of course, coming up later this year, which is an enormous achievement to be there in the first place. But I mean, that must be a huge motivating factor for you and everybody in the Ranasinghe team. You must be so looking forward to that.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, it is a big step for us. We are willing to put our best foot forward and just put Samoa out there, represent our country. So yeah, it will be exciting for us. We are definitely the underdogs, but I think we'll come out firing.
And you also play sevens for Samoa?
Yes, I do. It was my debut earlier this year in February. That was all new to me as well. But yeah, very exciting.
So what are your future plans then? I mean, are you happy to keep switching between sevens and 15s, or do you think in the end you'll have to choose one over the other?
If I could do both, I would. But I think just depending on what comes up and what's available then. 15s is fun, so I'll probably stick with 15s, yeah, if something comes up.
And how much of an inspiration for you and the rest of the team is your captain, Sui? I mean, she seems to have been around forever, and speaking to her in the recent past, I don't think she's going anywhere soon. So she's such a big figure in your team, isn't she?
She is. Yeah, everyone loves her. She gets along with everyone, and she's just so experienced in what she does. Yeah, she's a really good captain to have, and she knows her game. We all look up to her.
Just looking forward to this big clash against Fijiana coming up at the weekend. The fact that it's on Fijian soil, how does that impact on Manasina's preparations?
I think we have a good solid team and the support from back home, from our families. We did have a few family members come over and visit as well, which was good. Our goal is to beat Fiji in Fiji.
Looking to the future, Fiji, as we said, have this advantage of being so involved in Super W. They've won Super W. Pinion and Pacifica have had a couple of goes now playing warm-up games for that tournament. How close do you think that team is to being admitted into Super W? Would you be part of that if it was?
Oh, 100%. Benina is a good team to go through to end up in Ranasinghe. I would have been in Benina, but I chose to play for the sevens. But yeah, it would be great to have Benina in Super W. It would be good to grow the game and for the Pacific Islander girls to get involved as well.
So all in all, it'd be great to win on Saturday, but regardless of the result, there is a lot to look forward to, isn't there, for women's rugby in Samoa? It really seems to be gathering pace.
Yes, yep, definitely has picked up and the game is growing. And visiting schools as well, it's good to get recognition and just be good role models for the young ones.
Ranasinghe winger Davina Lassini on the line for Singatoka, where the mouth-watering clash between Samoa and Fiji will take place. That kicks off at 4 p.m. Fiji time tomorrow afternoon, and the reporter there was Richard Erwart. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. We'll be back at the same time Monday. That's 6 a.m. PNG time. You can also hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time with Eggy Tupo. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia through Because News is next. And coming up after that is Nisha Daily. This is Belinda Cora from PABC's Pacific Journalism Network program, wishing you all a great day.
Salofalava, I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific to celebrate our resilience, revival, and deep-rooted connection.
Search for Culture Compass wherever you get your podcasts to listen.